Kelly shook his head. Fortunately, she would have gone unconscious before she probably knew what was happening. Still, a hell of a way to go.
Yeah, said Decker, but a lot better than what happened to Irene Kramer.
Chapter 18.
It looks like the house on the TV show Dallas, only twice the size.
Jameson made this comment as she drove them up a long cobblestone driveway that was bracketed by two rows of large trees with full leafy canopies.
Where does Stuart McClellan live? Asked Decker.
He has an apartment in a building in downtown London.
An apartment?
Said Jameson.
Isn't he richer than Dawson?
He's been through so many booms and busts that I think he now hedges his bets.
And his son?
Shane has a little farmhouse and some land on the western edge of the county. Bought the place right after he came back.
Came back from where?
Asked Jameson. Fighting overseas. He was in the army. Joined up right after he graduated from high school. He likes it simple. Hunts during the season, drinks his beer, works for his old man, gets yelled at for not doing it well enough, and tries to enjoy life. It's no secret the father doesn't think the son is up to taking over his fracking operations.
And what do you think?
Said Jameson. Shane's no dummy, and he works hard. We've hunted together a lot. He's sharp, methodical, and knowledgeable about stuff he cares about. He just doesn't care for business. It's not how he's wired. They parked in front of the house and got out. Kelly led the way up the steps to the double front door.
So what will it be for us? Asked Decker. Gregarious, or do we get a knife in the back?
All depends on what and how you ask him, I guess.
Well, knowing Decker's tact, let's prepare for the shiv to the spine,
said Jameson, with a sly smile at her partner. The door was answered by a woman in a maid's uniform. After Kelly showed his badge, she stepped back so they could pass through. She led them down a hall with ash plank flooring to a set of oak double doors. Inside the room, the man who rose from behind a large desk was nearly as tall as Decker, but far thinner, with narrow hips. His brown, wavy hair had a thick shock of gray in the front. He was clean-shaven, with a nose that had been broken and healed slightly off-center. He was dressed in an untucked white shirt and black jeans. When he moved around the desk with his hand outstretched to Kelly, Decker noted the dark blue slippers on the man's feet with a D monogrammed on them. The walls were festooned with the heads of unfortunate creatures who had had their mortal remains fashioned into showpieces.
Joe, how the hell are you? Been a while.
Kelly shook his hand and then introduced Decker and Jameson to Hugh Dawson. They all sat in front of an empty stone fireplace, and Kelly said,
Thanks for meeting with us. Guess you'll be heading out of the country in a month or so.
Dawson looked at Decker and Jameson.
I used to laugh at the snowbirds who would head south for the winter. Then a number of years ago, Maddie suggested we start spending the winters in Australia when it's their summer. We rented a place near the water. After she passed, I kept going. We had some really wonderful times down there.
Memories like that are important, said Jameson. Like therapy.
Yes, they are. Now, I understand a woman was murdered, and Hal Parker found her.
He was out looking for a wolf, said Jameson.
That damn thing had already killed two of my cows. Hired Hal to get rid of it.
How do you know it was a wolf? Asked Decker.
They finally found the carcass with Hal's bullet in it. So who was it that got killed again?
A woman named Irene Kramer, said Kelly. Thought you would have known that. We released her name. In answer, Dawson pointed to his desk that was stacked with three-ring binders.
I'm up to my eyeballs in financial stuff, working on some big deals. I haven't watched or listened to the news for a while.
But you knew of the murder, obviously, said Decker.
I knew because Hal told me.
So you didn't know her?
Asked Decker. He shook his head.
Used to be I knew everybody around these parts. Now too many people coming in. I'm not complaining. It's good for business.
Irene Kramer worked as the teacher at the brothers' school, said Kelly.
The brothers? I do business with them. Their word is their bond.
What about the military installation?
Asked Decker. Dawson's eyes narrowed.
London Air Force Station? What about it?
Do you do business with them, too?
Sure. Their folks come to town and frequent my places, and we provide some of their supplies. Why?
Decker shrugged.
It's a murder investigation. We ask questions about everybody.
Dawson glanced at Kelly.
But why do the feds get called in on a local murder?
Kelly said, We always appreciate the help.
Dawson eyed him skeptically.
And I can sell you the Brooklyn Bridge.
We met your daughter,
interjected Jameson.
You must be very proud of her.
Dawson grinned.
She's going to be running the world before long. She'll leave what I did in the dust when all is said and done.
She's dating a man named Stan Baker, said Decker. We met him, too.
The light seemed to dim in Dawson's eyes.
Is that right? Well, I keep out of that. She's grown and can make her own decisions, especially when it comes to men.
Jameson said,
Wow, I wish my father would be as enlightened. I'm in my 30s and I still get detailed emails and phone calls about my personal relationships.
Dawson grinned.
Oh, I tried to poke my nose in here and there. The fourth time it got chopped off, I said, Okay, I'm done here. Not worth it.
His expression darkened.
Then after Maddie died,
an awkward silence persisted until he said,
Anything else you folks want to ask me?
He glanced at the papers on his desk.
We understand that your son committed suicide, said Decker.
Dawson immediately tightened.
He took the coward's way out, yeah. But what the hell does that have to do with anything?
He snapped, glowering at Kelly, who looked taken aback by Decker's comment. Decker said,
We also understand that you and Stuart McClellan are best friends.
Dawson looked wildly at Decker for a few moments and then burst out laughing.
Okay, I didn't figure you for having a sense of humor. Fact is, that's been blown way out of proportion. I'm not saying the guy and I will be going on vacation together anytime soon, but the town is booming and we're both making money hand over fist. And we don't compete. We're more complimentary.
His tone became more businesslike.
But this has nothing to do with a gal being murdered, right?
Like I said, we ask lots of questions in the hopes of finding a path forward.
Sounds to me like you're trying to dig through mud to get to the gold.
It always seems that way right before you hit the mother lode, replied Decker.
Jameson said,
We met Stuart McClellan and his son, Shane. Your daughter was there, too. At the hotel where we're staying, it's one of your places.
Okay, so? Said Dawson.
Any idea why the McClellans would be there?
Asked Jameson.
Caroline seemed surprised that they were.
It's a free country. They can go where they want.
He grinned.
And hell, I don't mind old Stuart putting some cash in my pocket.
Shane seemed quite smitten with Caroline,
pointed out Jameson.
Dawson stood. Well, it was nice meeting you. Maybe I'll see you around.
The others stood too, but Decker remained seated.
Your daughter was making an offer to buy the apartment building where Irene Kramer lived. Did you know about that?
Caroline doesn't have to come to me for every little thing. We are trying to acquire properties, and now's a good time to do it. Stuff is relatively cheap.
But you'd think prices would be going up in a boom,
said Jameson.
It was booming last time, too, and then in a few years everything went to hell.
He paused and rubbed his chin.
What do you folks know about fracking?
Jameson said,
Just what we read in the papers, so not much.
We produce more oil than any other state except Texas. But with fracking, there are two downsides. First is, you get overwhelmed by the people coming in for the good-paying jobs, and drugs, prostitution, and other crime and shit like that goes through the roof. And you can't build the homes, schools, roads, and stores and all the other stuff people want fast enough. Then there's the second downside. You get busts. Last time, oil prices went through the floor overnight and stayed there because OPEC increased production to drive the frackers out of business. Then everything around here shut down, and I mean everything. I got close to losing every nickel I had. But that's also how McClellan really solidified his hold on the shale land around here.
What do you mean?
Asked Jameson.
When the fracking industry really came into vogue a while back, the big boys came up here loaded for bear, and they gobbled up all the available leases and paid top dollar for them. But with the bust cycle, they fell by the wayside, and McClellan bought up their leases for pennies on the dollar. And he has his business model all squared away, so apparently no more booms and busts for him.
Jameson said,
"That still doesn't answer my question about the prices around here now."
"Well, despite McClellan's operations being in good shape, people are getting damn nervous, waiting for the rug to get pulled out again. So it creates opportunities for those with a healthier appetite for risk." "But you almost pulled out a few years ago," commented Kelly.
Dawson glared at him.
"Maddie didn't want to live here anymore. She'd been through hell and back with me. The last bust came, but then things started picking up again. But she'd had enough by then. She wanted out, come hell or high water. We had a few dollars left, so we were going to buy a little villa in France and spend our golden years there. But then..."
"We understand she died in an accident?"
asked Jameson. He nodded.
"I was out of the country, and she ran off the road during a blizzard. She didn't realize that the rear of the car had run up against a berm. It had bent her tailpipe and clogged it," said Dawson, the misery clear in his eyes. "She breathed in all that crap and died."
"Why were you out of the country?" asked Decker.
"I was buying the place in France. Caroline was with me."
"So she was going to live there with you?"
"She was tired of this place, too. Fresh start all around. And it's what Maddie wanted."
He glanced at Decker.
"But again, why would any of that be relevant to your investigation?"
Decker rose.
"I take the position that everything is relevant until it isn't."
"And you didn't answer my question from before. I still don't know why you feds got called in on a local killing."
"Well, on that one, you can join the club," said Decker, as he headed for the door.
Chapter 19. As they drove back to town, Jameson glanced at Decker and said,
"You should fill Kelly in on what you found."
Decker proceeded to tell Kelly about what he had done with Kramer's corpse. The local detective's eyes kept widening the longer that Decker talked.
"Okay, I thought I had heard it all, but you just took it to another level."
"Wasn't on my wish list, I can tell you that."
Kelly said,
"You really think she was carrying something inside her?"
"It would explain why her intestines and belly were sliced open. I think the rest of the autopsy done by whoever killed her was just to cover that part up."
"It would have to be a lot of drugs to justify killing someone."
Jameson shook her head.
"But these days you don't need mules to transport drugs. The U.S. Postal Service unwittingly does it, or FedEx, or UPS.
"Which is why I don't think it was drugs," replied Decker, causing Jameson to gape.
"Well, thanks for sharing, Decker,"
she groused.
He looked back at Kelly.
"Tell me something. How well do you know Walt Southern?"
"Pretty well. Why?"
"I'm just wondering."
Jameson caught a look from him that said not to comment further.
"And now, let's head out and do something we should have already done," said Decker.
"What's that?"
asked Kelly.
"Go to the scene of the crime,"
answered Jameson. It was a breathtakingly beautiful view, made ugly only by the purpose of the visit. Decker was staring out over the spot where Kramer's body had been found. In the distance, one could see the humps of the Badlands. The sky was the clearest it had been since they had arrived. To the north was Saskatchewan, to the west, the vast footprint of Montana. Decker was interested in neither. His sole focus was this little patch of North Dakota soil where someone had dumped Irene Kramer's body. As he gazed around, his mind was analyzing a million different factors. Only one of them might hold any importance for the investigation, but you had to go through all of them to get there. It seemed both a likely and an unlikely place to find a dead body. Likely in that it was isolated and remote, and that was good for getting rid of unwanted dead bodies without being seen. But unlikely in that such wide open spaces allowed no cover for anyone disposing of said dead bodies. One could literally see for miles. But at night, it would have been a different story.
"What's near here?"
he asked Kelly, who was leaning next to the SUV. Jameson was hovering to the right of Decker and staring at the spot where Kramer had been found.
"Hugh Dawson's cattle ranch is that way,"
Kelly pointed west.
About 2 miles. It's a big place. He has a lot of land, but we have an abundance of that around here.
Dawson said they found the wolf. Where?
About 300 yards from here, with Parker's round still in it, like you said. Dang thing was pretty big. If Hal had arrived much later, that critter would have torn up Kramer's remains. We lucked out there.
Did he say why he was hunting in this particular area?
Asked Jameson, who was now kneeling down and more closely examining the ground where the body had lain.
He told me he'd been tracking it the last 3 nights. He drew up a range of places to check, based on the animal's hunting pattern. I hunt too, but not like Hal. He's a real pro, can track anything anywhere. He said this quadrant was a likely spot to pick the wolf up based on that analysis. He'd been at it about 2 hours before he caught sight of the thing and took his kill shot.
Are we sure it was the same wolf that had attacked the cattle?
Yeah, they found some of the remains of the animals in its belly.
Were there any tracks around Kramer's body, foot or car tire or anything like that?
We did check for that, but the problem was a heavy rain had started up right when Hal found the body. If there were any tracks, they got washed away when that happened.
And Parker didn't mention seeing any before the rain hit? Asked Decker.
No, and that's the other reason I don't think there were any. The guy's a seasoned hunter and tracker. If there had been any, he would have spotted them and told us.
So the fact that the body was untouched by animals could be because it was dumped here shortly before Parker found it, like you suggested previously, Decker,
said Jameson.
So we might have lucked out there.
And the wolf might have been in this area because it caught the scent of the dead body, added Kelly. But that doesn't explain the insect infestation.
Decker said, she could have been kept somewhere else, where flies and insects could have gotten to her, but animals couldn't have.
But why would the killer bother doing that? Asked Kelly.
He might want to screw with the timing of death, which would make our job harder. And if there was something inside her that he wanted to get, that would have taken time, and he couldn't cut her open while she was alive. At least I hope he didn't.
Jameson said.
Was anyone else around to see or hear anything?
Kelly shook his head. No, just Hal. Doubt there was another living person anywhere near here at that time of night.
How far away does Parker live? Asked Decker.
About 45 minutes from here.
Well, let's go hear his story.
Chapter 20. The road was long, dusty, and wide open to the waves of heat shimmering under a sun that seemed closer to the earth than it should have been. In the distance, they could see oil rigs pumping and a sea of gas flares burning off straight into the atmosphere. They passed one tanker truck that had gone off the road and was driving through what looked like farmland.
What the hell is he doing?
Asked Jameson, who was driving the SUV.
Dumping his saltwater waste, Kelly replied, looking angry. Some of what comes back up the pipe after it goes down it to fracture the shale. What that trucker is doing is against the law. He'll ruin that land for farming forever because the salt permanently burns the soil to nothing. They pull that shit all the time just to save themselves time and trouble. We find the crap out of them, and they still keep doing it.
How much farther? Asked Decker.
It's right up ahead, on the left.
They rounded a curve and a modest ranch house came into view. An old and battered gray pickup truck was parked outside.
Parker have any family?
Asked Jameson.
No, his wife died. His kids are grown and gone.
As they climbed out of the SUV, Decker glanced down at the bumper sticker on the rear of Parker's truck. Gun control means using both hands. Kelly led the way up the plank steps. The front door was standing partially open. Seeing that, all three instinctively pulled their weapons. Kelly called out through the opening.
Hal? It's Joe Kelly. You in there? You okay? We want to ask you some questions.
There were sounds coming from inside, but they were unintelligible.
Hal? You okay?
Kelly cried out again. He looked at Decker.
What the hell is going on here?
Decker looked at him.
Your call. Do we go in?
You bet we do.
Kelly took the lead, pushed the door fully open with the palm of his free hand, and they all charged inside. The front room was plainly furnished with a Remington shotgun and Winchester rifle on a rack on one wall, and two fishing rods leaning in a corner. An open beer can was on a table next to a recliner, but there was no sign of Parker.
"Al?"
called out Kelly again. Decker took in the space, top to bottom, left to right.
It looked like Parker had just stood and walked out of the room.
The TV was still on. Those were obviously the sounds they had heard. On one wall was a series of photos. Decker ran his gaze over each of them. They were pictures of Parker and members of various hunting parties next to the carcasses of large dead animals.
"That's Shane in that one," said Decker.
Kelly nodded.
"Yeah, they hunt a lot together. I'm in that one over there. Got an 8-point buck on that trip," he added, indicating another photo.
He looked around.
"I don't like this one bit. He wouldn't leave his door open like that."
"Does he have a vehicle other than the truck?"
asked Jameson.
"He has an ATV. Keeps it in the shed out back."
They quickly searched the house, including the small bedroom, but found no one there.
"Bed is still made," noted Kelly.
Decker walked back into the front room and touched the beer on the table.
"Warm. Would he be drinking during the day?"
"Not the Hal Parker I know."
Decker went into the kitchen, slapped on a pair of latex gloves he'd pulled from his pocket, and opened the dishwasher. There was one plate, a set of utensils, and a water glass inside. He eyed Jameson, who had followed him.
"Dinner last night. Beer while watching TV. Whatever happened, I think it took place last night."
Next, he eyed the two wine glasses and a half-empty bottle of wine on the counter.
"One beer can, but two wine glasses. How does that figure in?"
"Somebody showed up while he was drinking beer and watching TV, maybe," speculated Kelly. "They crack open some wine and drink it. Then either that person takes Hal, or somebody else comes in here and takes him and the other person. But I don't know who that could be."
"He have any enemies?"
asked Jameson.
"Never heard anyone say a word against him. Everybody liked Hal."
"Let's check the shed," said Decker.
They trooped outside to the small plank shed. It had an overhead garage door that wasn't locked. With his latex gloves still on, Decker carefully lifted the door, and it rolled up on well-oiled tracks, while the other two stood ready, their guns pointed at the emerging opening, ready for whatever might be revealed. There was a Honda ATV parked right inside the small space. Decker had half expected to see the body of Hal Parker in here. Parker wasn't inside, but another dead body was. She was on the ATV, lying forward on her front side so her torso and head were resting against the handlebars, with her legs splayed out behind her. She was dressed in a short, tight skirt, a low-cut, body-hugging midriff top, thigh-high black stockings, and spiky shoes. On the right side of the woman's head was a bloody hole where a bullet had ended her life. They all just stared at the body for a few moments.
"She's young. Looks to be in her early 20s, noted Decker as he gazed at the body.
He glanced at Kelly.
"Do you know who she is?"
Kelly nodded, looking grim.
"She's Pamela Ames, Susan and Milton's oldest daughter from the colony."
"But she's not dressed like the other women there,"
pointed out Jameson.
"She's dressed, well, pretty alluringly."
"And I wonder why," said Decker.
Chapter 21. As Decker stared across the width of the London police station's main room, he had a sense of déjà vu, and for a horrible reason. Milton and Susan Ames were sitting in two straight-back chairs after having been told of the murder of their daughter and having viewed and identified her remains at the funeral home. Years ago, Decker had found the bodies of his wife, daughter, and brother-in-law in their home in Burlington, Ohio. He had called the cops and then sat on the bathroom floor, staring at his daughter. Molly Decker had been bound to the toilet using the belt of her bathrobe after her killer had used that very same belt to strangle her to death. Decker had sat there with his service pistol in hand. He had finally stuck it into his mouth and was seriously contemplating eating around and dying with them. But something, he wasn't exactly sure what, had stopped him. After his brain injury, his personality had also changed. Thus, he was no longer adept in moments like this, that called for delicacy and empathy. He usually said the wrong thing or made the wrong gesture. It was just a disconnect he often could not control. He refocused on the grieving Ameses. He would ordinarily leave this sort of thing to Jameson. She was now sitting next to him and studying the Ameses as well. She touched his hand and started to say something, but at that moment Decker got up and walked over to the stricken people. He knelt down in front of them. Jameson looked on fearfully, no doubt thinking her partner would not be up to dealing with the bereaved parents. Susan Ames had aged a decade since he had last seen her. The woman's face was fallen in, her eyes bloodshot, her hands shaking, her thin chest heaving unevenly. Her scarf had fallen off, and she hadn't seemed to have noticed. Milton simply stared down at his hands, his eyes reddened from the tears shed. Susan focused on Decker when he picked up the scarf and held it out to her. As her fingers closed around it, he said,
"I'm so very sorry."
Susan nodded.
She was very smart. She could have...
She shook her head, unable to finish. Decker cleared his throat and said,
"I had a daughter. She was smart and could have been anything, too. But somebody took that opportunity away from her."
Now Milton looked at Decker as though he were just now seeing him for the first time. Decker continued,
"And I caught that person. And I will do the same for your daughter, because she deserves nothing less."
Susan slowly nodded and murmured,
"Thank you."
Jameson sat there transfixed by what she was seeing. When Decker turned to her, she tried to assume a normal expression, but she wasn't quick enough. He showed no reaction to this. He rose and said to the Ameses,
"I know this is a really hard time, but the sooner we can get some information from you, the faster we can catch whoever did this."
Milton just sat there, but Susan nodded.
"We understand."
Kelly appeared in the doorway, having overheard this last part.
"If you're ready, then," he said quietly.
The Ameses rose as though roped together and followed them down the hall to a small windowless room with one rectangular table and four chairs, two on either side. They all sat except Decker. He leaned against the wall, his thick arms folded over his broad chest.
"Okay, the most obvious question. Was there any connection between Hal Parker and your daughter?"
asked Kelly, his small notepad open and his pen hovering.
"None that I know of,"
said Susan.
"There would be no reason, you see. He never worked for us. We didn't require his services. He never came to the colony. She never mentioned him."
"Okay," said Kelly. "When was the last time you saw Pamela?"
At this, Susan glanced nervously at her husband. Decker said,
"We found her at about 1 p.m. Prelim on the time of death was around 9:00 last night, so there's a long gap of time unaccounted for."
Milton looked up, his eyes watery.
"She had left the colony. Pammy had left us."
"When did this happen?"
said a clearly surprised Kelly.
"I hadn't heard anything about that."
"Well, we don't broadcast when people leave us,"
said Susan, assuming a more measured and prim manner.
"It's not something we like to dwell upon."
"And it happens very infrequently," Milton hastened to add. "But we can't keep someone against their will, not when they're of age. We would never do that."
"But we did counsel her. We tried to show her how bad it would be,"
said Susan.
"Let's get back to what happened to your daughter," said Decker.
At this comment, both Milton's and Susan's eyes filled with fresh tears. Jameson handed them both Kleenexes, which they used to wipe their eyes.
"Pammy was bored with life at the colony," began Milton. "And because of that, we let her go and stay with my cousin's family in San Antonio last year. She got a taste of life outside. She apparently liked it very much. When she got back, she told us she wanted to leave, go back to San Antonio, and enroll in some classes, find a job, and..."
"Start living her life,"
finished Susan.
But then you tried to talk her out of it,
said Jameson.
Like you said.
And we were unsuccessful, as we also told you,
replied Susan stiffly.
When exactly did she leave the colony? Asked Kelly.
A month ago, answered Milton brusquely. But she didn't go to San Antonio, Decker pointed out. She was still here, unless she went out there and came back.
She hadn't gone yet, said Milton in a small voice.
What was she waiting for?
Asked Jameson. Milton was about to answer when Susan cleared her throat. He glanced at his wife, who was staring at him with such a rigid expression that it was like she had been transformed from flesh to wood. Milton shut his mouth and looked away while Decker watched this interaction closely. She said,
We live a communal life here and have no personal resources, but we could have asked the community to provide her with some means to travel to San Antonio and given her a bit of a cushion until she became self-sustaining. But you didn't,
said Jameson. Susan could only shake her head. Milton said,
We thought it would be a way to make her come home.
He broke down entirely now and rested his forehead on the table, his body quaking. His wife didn't look at him, but she did pat him gently on the back. Decker eyed Kelly and said,
We'll need to check her movements, friends, whether she had a job, where she was staying, and what, if any, connection she had to Hal Parker.
He stopped and stared over at Susan.
Before, you said that Parker never came to the colony, but then you said that you had never required his services, which implies that you knew what he did for a living. Did you know Hal Parker, Ms. Ames?
She glanced at her husband, who was still bent over, weeping quietly.
I knew him, yes. Unlike Milton, I have not always been here at the colony. When I was younger, much younger, I lived in London with my parents. Hal was older than I was, but our families were neighbors, so I would see him a good deal when I was a child. I know what he does for a living.
Jameson said,
So did Pamela know him? Might she have gone to him for help when she left here?
It's possible,
said Susan.
I don't know for sure.
Jameson frowned.
You didn't keep in touch with her?
Susan said defensively.
She didn't have a cell phone.
I find that hard to believe,
said Jameson.
Even if she wasn't used to having access to one at the colony, it would be hard to do without one once she had left there.
Kelly added,
And London's not that big. Surely you could have gone to see her.
I chose not to see her,
snapped Susan.
She had made her choice. She didn't want to be a part of our world anymore.
Decker pushed off the wall, came forward, and said offhandedly,
So she might have been staying with Parker, and if someone came there to take him away and she was there, she might have just been in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Kelly nodded in agreement.
That could be, yes.
Jameson said,
But Decker, it's a one-bedroom house, and we didn't find any clothing or other things that would indicate that Pamela Ames was living there, and there was no vehicle other than Parker's.
She gazed up at him, puzzled.
You know all that.
Decker kept his gaze on Milton.
That's right, Alex. So now maybe Milton can tell us what his wife doesn't want us to know.
All eyes turned to Milton as he slowly sat back against his chair. He rubbed his eyes and would not look at his wife this time.
Unlike Susan, I did keep in touch with Pammy.
And?
Said Decker.
And she was working as a waitress at the big truck stop on the main road coming into town.
She told you this?
No, I heard it from someone else, a trucker who makes deliveries here. He knew Pammy. He told me she was there. I went there to see her, but when I saw...
I'm sorry, but I'm not sure what you're getting at,
said Jameson.
When you saw what?
Well, what she was wearing. What all the waitresses wore in that place. They were barely clothed, and all the men ogling them. It was... I just couldn't believe that my daughter...
Susan made a clucking sound and glanced at her husband with a scathing look. Milton swallowed nervously and looked down.
And you told her what you thought about it?
Said Jameson. He nodded, still looking down.
I told her I was ashamed of her and never wanted to see her again.
On that, Milton broke into sobs and couldn't answer another question. Chapter 22. Decker looked out the window of his hotel room onto a street that was bustling with people and traffic. This fracking stuff, he thought, had really transformed parts of North Dakota from a flyover state to one of the world's great economic booms. He still didn't know why Pamela Ames had been at Hal Parker's. If she'd had a purse, it had also been taken. Ditto for her cell phone. The gun that had killed Pamela was nowhere to be found. They had also found no trace of Ames having been in Parker's truck, so how she had gotten out there was still unknown. Walt Southern would be doing the post-mortem, and Decker was hoping something would pop from that. They had spoken with the truck stop people. Ames had been working there. She had missed her shift that night. They had tried to call her phone, which they confirmed she had, but had gotten no answer. Kelly had tried to trace the phone's location, but gotten nothing. They were also trying to trace where Ames had been living, but so far had gotten zip, and the truck stop people hadn't known that either. The company didn't mail out paychecks. They just handed them out at the end of the week, her manager had told them. If she had moved around or lived in abandoned premises, as some did here, it might be impossible to pinpoint exactly where she had been on any given day. Decker checked his watch. He was due to meet Baker at the OK Corral Saloon in 30 minutes. He called Bogart's personal cell, got the man's voicemail, and left a message. How and whether Kramer's death coincided with Pamela Ames's murder and Hal Parker's disappearance, he didn't know. And had Parker been abducted? Or had he killed Ames for some reason and then run for it? He washed up, changed into clean clothes, and headed out. He met Baker as the big man was walking up to the bar.
How's the investigation going?
It's going. How's the fracking?
He grinned.
Hot, and I'm not talking temperature-wise.
They went inside, miraculously found an empty table, and ordered two beers on draft. When the drinks came, they each drained about half their mugs.
I spoke to Renee again, said Decker.
Yeah, she told me. I hope you feel better about things.
Look, Stan, you don't have to worry about whether I feel better or not. If you two are good with it and the kids are taken care of, then that's great.
Baker looked surprised, but also pleased by this statement.
Thanks, Amos. I still care for Renee, and she does for me. Guess it'll always be that way. We were together a long time, and then we got the kids, of course. That's the glue that really holds a family together regardless. The kids.
Baker paled a bit with this last part.
I know exactly what you mean, Stan, Decker said, taking a sip of his beer. So you like it here, you said.
Oh, yeah. Some of the younger guys, they think it's too isolated. Hell, I've lived in Alaska. Isolated takes on a whole other meaning up there.
So tell me about this fracking business, said Decker.
Baker looked surprised.
Why does that matter to you?
I'm investigating a murder. People get killed for lots of reasons, like money and power. The money and power thing here is tied to fracking, right?
Right. Otherwise, pretty much nobody would be here. So what do you want to know?
Basically how it works.
There's oil and gas in the ground, and folks pull it out and sell it for a lot of money.
That part I get. Only I understand it wasn't always that easy to get out of the ground.
That's right. So before I came here, I read up on it. I'm not a young punk with no obligations. I needed to make this work, so I wanted to know whether this thing had legs. North Dakota has gone boom and bust before.
Understood. Go on.
Well, the first bit of oil in North Dakota was discovered in a small town called Tioga back in the early 50s. But drilling up here, in the Bakken region, was considered a no-go because the oil was too hard to get out. All the big boys had given it a try over the decades and failed. They just assumed that it would be stuck down there forever. So by the end of the 90s, drilling was done here. Then, it turned out the oil companies were drilling in the wrong direction. Vertical doesn't work here like it does pretty much everywhere else. You had to drill horizontally after you've drilled vertically down far enough to reach the shale region. And you had to do that in combination with fracking, or piping water and mud and chemicals down into the deposits. That's done both to keep the drill going and to break up the shale. And you send shale down, too, in order to keep the breaks in the shale from resealing.
You mean like stents a surgeon puts in to open up a blocked artery?
Exactly. And on the extraction end, think of a straw inserted into a cup of water. You pour more liquid and other stuff through the straw and into the water. With no place else to go, the water down below has to come up through the straw. Here, after fracking a deposit, the oil starts to flow to the surface.
How far down do you go?
About 2 miles vertically, and then you move sideways, or horizontally, in a series of carefully monitored stages. That could be quite a few more miles. All told, you're talking about 20,000 feet or more of drilling and piping.
Then all these rigs I see around are over deposits of oil and gas?
Yeah. You pretty much always find one with the other. It takes anywhere from 1 to 5 million gallons of fresh water to frack a single well, and a couple thousand truckloads of sand. Each well from site prep to readiness for production takes about 3 to 6 months. But then the well could be productive for 20, 30, or 40 years. When all the oil and gas have been gotten out, they plug everything, clean up the surface, and the owner who leased the land goes back to using the property.
What's your job in all this?
When I first came here, I was just a run-of-the-mill oil field hand. I ran pipe and worked drilling rigs with all the youngsters. Then when they found out I had real experience, they put me in charge of monitoring operations at some of the rigs. I get to sit in a trailer and watch computer screens. I'll show you sometime if you want.
That'd be great, Stan. I appreciate that.
Baker smiled.
What?
Asked Decker.
This is the most I've seen and talked to you since you graduated from college and went pro.
Right, said Decker. So tell me about Caroline Dawson.
Baker looked embarrassed.
I know, you're thinking, what is a rich, smart, beautiful young gal doing with a big old lug like me?
That wasn't what I was thinking.
You're a bad liar.
So?
So I came into this bar one day, and there she was. Hell, she was mixing drinks. I thought she was just a bartender earning her daily bread here.
Why would she be mixing drinks?
Her father owns the bar.
I didn't know that, but I guess it makes sense. But surely she doesn't need the money.
She likes to get her hands dirty with all the lines of work they're involved in. She's done maid service at some of the hotels and apartment buildings, cashiering at some of the stores, even drove a semi. She has her CDL. Added Baker, referring to a commercial driver's license.
Decker looked impressed.
Okay, that speaks well of her.
Anyway, I ordered a beer from her, not even knowing who she was. Of course, all these young drunk punks were hitting on her all night, but she kept her cool. She seemed interested in me, maybe because I wasn't hitting on her, and also because I knew some of the punks and told them to back off. She asked questions, and I told her a little bit about myself. Showed her pictures of the kids. Then she told me what time her shift ended.
Why did she do that? Did she want to meet up with you later?
No, and she only told me because I asked. She seemed a little put off by that, like I was hitting on her. But then I told her I just wanted to make sure she got home okay, because those punks were not leaving well enough alone. She told me she had her car outside. It's a sweet ride. A Porsche SUV with these special wide tires and fancy tread. Her father bought it for her birthday. Of course, I only found out about that later.
Okay, what happened?
Well, I was waiting across the street from the bar when she came out, just to be sure. Two of the punks who'd been harassing her followed her out. She told them to get lost, but they were drunk and wouldn't listen. It started to get dicey. Them pawing her, and I was afraid it might move on to something really bad. So I ran across and, well, persuaded them to leave her alone.
Decker smiled.
And how exactly did you do that, Stan?
Mostly by knocking them out cold. I don't think they expected that from a guy my age. Anyway, Caroline was really grateful, and, well, she asked me out. Couldn't believe it. Never had a gal do that, not even Renee, and she's no shrinking violet. So we see each other from time to time. I'm not in her league, but, well, she makes me feel good about myself, I guess. And she's fun. I guess everybody deserves to have some fun, right?
Absolutely. Have you met her father?
No, and we've never, I mean, we haven't, you know.
Slept together?
Right. We're just friends.
Full disclosure, I followed you here that first night. She was hanging all over you.
The gal likes to have fun, but I'm in my 50s. Hell, I could be her father.
Hasn't stopped people in the past.
Yeah, well. Baker hunkered down over his drink.
You both disappeared when I wasn't looking. Thought you might have, well.
Nah, Caroline keeps a room over the bar. She went up there. She had a headache, she said. I went home.
Okay.
Decker pulled out a picture of Irene Kramer that Kelly had provided and slid it across.
You know her or even seen her?
Baker picked up the photo and studied it.
She the gal that got killed?
Decker nodded.
Irene Kramer. She taught over at the Brothers Colony.
Schoolteacher, huh? Who'd want to kill a schoolteacher?
She also had a sideline. An escort. Went by the name Mindy.
Okay, exclaimed Baker, sliding the photo back. I've never seen her, and I don't mess with escorts. I've got 4 kids. I don't want any more by accident. I'd rather just drink my beer and watch movies.
Know any young punks that might have seen things differently?
Oh, yeah, more than a few.
Decker slid the photo back across.
Then show this around and see what comes up. Now, what do you know about the Air Force Station?
I pass by it every day, going to and coming from work.
I went out there and spoke with the commander of the place. Tight-lipped.
Yeah, they take things seriously over there, or so I've heard. Lots of security.
He told me it was a pretty safe place to work, no accidents. But they had a line of ambulances there, so it didn't make sense.
Baker took this in, and his features slowly clouded.
What is it?
Asked Decker, who had noted this.
Well, some of the guys from there used to come into the bars from time to time. I wore the uniform, so we speak the same language. They're Air Force and I was Army, but still, I did enough joint ops and training to get along with them.
Okay.
Well, I was drinking with some of them one night, and one fella, I think his name was Ben, said something odd. Stuck with me, see? Memorable, what he said.
So what the hell did he say?
Before answering, Baker finished his beer and then looked directly at Decker.
That we were all sitting on a fucking time bomb.
Chapter 23. Decker and Baker each had another beer and split a plate of chili, chips, and jalapenos, and then headed out of the saloon. Neither one had noticed the knot of young men who had been closely watching them at the bar. It was dark now, and the streets were emptier than they had been, not only because of the late hour, but also because of the fine rain that had begun falling. They hadn't gone more than a block down a side street where Baker had parked his truck, and which was also a shortcut to Decker's hotel, when Decker slowed.
What's up?
Said Baker, noting this.
We have some company, and I don't think they're friendly. Look.
Baker gazed ahead where 3 young men stood, blocking their path. Then Decker looked behind them. 3 more men barred the way they had come.
Buddies of yours? Asked Decker.
As the men came closer on both sides, Baker said quietly,
I recognize a couple. Guys I busted up for going after Caroline that time.
Thought it might be that. Guess they're here for payback.
This isn't your fight, Amos. I can see if they'll let you pass.
Decker gave him an incredulous look.
You really think I'm leaving you here to face this alone, Stan?
Baker grinned.
Well, this won't be the first fight we've been in together.
And probably won't be the last.
See any weapons?
I think one of them might have a knife.
Decker looked behind him, and one has a baseball bat.
You have your gun?
Unfortunately, I left it in my room. Didn't think I'd need it to have a beer with you. I can flash my creds at them.
Hell, those idiots probably can't even read.
Okay.
Looks like we're going to have to do this the old-fashioned way. I'm not thrilled about that because I'm wearing my good clothes and don't want to mess them up with their blood and stuff.
I don't see a way around it, Stan.
Decker looked to his left and saw a row of garbage cans.
You want the guy with the knife or the bat?
I'm actually partial to the knife guys. Hey, I remember that game against Michigan your senior year. What'd you do again?
The center spit in my face after I sacked the QB, so I pile-drove him into the turf. Got a 15-yard personal foul call, but it was worth it, and we won, so hey.
That's right, now I remember. Okay, you might want to pull that one out of your playbook, because here they come.
The six men rushed forward, the bat and the knife leading the way. Neither Decker nor Baker moved until the very last possible second. When the bat guy was within a foot of Decker, he grabbed a garbage can lid, swung it around, and caught the man flush in the face. He dropped the bat and fell backward with blood streaming down his features and two teeth missing. Baker stepped up to the knife wielder. When the man began his downward thrust, Baker used his forearm to block it. Then he deftly gripped the man's wrist, ripped the arm behind him, and cranked the elbow upward past all breaking points, and the man's shoulder separated cleanly and painfully. He dropped to the ground, screaming and cursing. Decker had picked up the baseball bat and used it to club the knee of one man, then used the wood to stroke a kidney punch on the third fellow. When the second man came at him again, Decker dropped the bat, flipped him around, heaved him into the air by the waist, and slammed him into the ground. The man let out a long groan, closed his eyes, and fell unconscious. Meanwhile, Baker drove his hammy fist into one man's face, breaking his nose, which spewed blood, and knocking him up against the brick wall. He slumped down, senseless. The last man was the smartest of them all. He took to his heels and sprinted off before either Decker or Baker could get to him. Baker looked at the fallen men, then reached down and took out the wallet of the guy he'd knocked out.
"What are you doing?"
asked Decker, as he watched Baker extract 20 bucks from the wallet before dropping it on the man's chest. In answer, his brother-in-law pointed to his shirt, where it was heavily stained.
"His blood got on my new shirt. I'm not paying for that."
He nudged the man's arm with his boot.
"Idiot."
He folded the cash and put it in his pocket. Decker looked down at the fallen men who were still conscious and flashed his badge.
"I could arrest all of you for being stupid, but I don't want to fill out the paperwork. Now, those of you who need medical attention, can you get there or get your buddies there without us calling anybody? Because if you leave it to us, it could take a while, and then all of you morons are going to jail."
"Bullshit, man," yelled one of them. "Who the hell do you think you are?"
Decker took out his official creds and pointed to them.
"This is FBI. It stands for Federal Bureau of Investigation, in case you didn't know. So if I press charges, you guys are going to a federal lockup a long way from here to spend about 10 years contemplating your evil ways. And the guys you'll be spending that time with won't be nearly as nice as me and my friend are."
The man who Decker had clubbed in the knee looked up and nodded.
"We can take care of each other," he said quickly. "No need for you to stick around, sir."
"Fuck you,"
screamed the man whose shoulder Baker had separated.
"Did you think of that one all by yourself?"
said Decker dryly. He and Baker walked down the street to the next block over and parted company there.
"I'll call you tomorrow about coming out to the work site," said Decker.
"I'm usually there 6 in the morning until 6 in the evening, and thanks for helping me back there. Wasn't your fight."
"I'm not sure you needed me," replied Decker.
He left Baker there and continued on his way. The street he was on was even emptier than the previous ones. The rain was falling harder now, and Decker picked up his pace. He calculated that if he took a shortcut down the alley coming up, he would shave his time in half. He ducked into the alley as the rain picked up. He was about halfway down it when something hit him from the side. It was as hard as a Mack truck and took Decker right off his feet. It reminded him of the blindside tackle he'd taken that had led to his brain trauma. An instant later, a gun was fired, and the bullet hit the brick wall opposite right where Decker would have been. It punched a 2-inch hole in the wall, and as soon as it did, a mini-explosion happened, and flames licked the brick. If it had struck him, he'd have been a dead man. The person who had hit him was lying on top of Decker. He whispered into Decker's ear,
"Stay down and stay safe. I'll be right back."
The next moment, Decker was all alone. Chapter 24. The man who had fired the shot at Decker was now sprinting from his concealed position. He had followed Decker to the alley after shadowing him most of the evening. When Decker and his friend had been attacked by the group of thugs, the man thought his work might be done by them. He wasn't thrilled with having missed, but for some reason Decker had gone down right as he had fired.
As though someone had... Shit, the mission's been compromised.
He picked up his pace as the rain soaked him. He did this for a living, and his paranoia antennae were kicking into high gear. His weapon was a custom-built .44-caliber pistol with a special long barrel to give it more range. He had the big man right in the crosshairs, pulled the trigger, and gotten zipped for all his troubles. He was irritated. Not only would he not get paid, he might get killed for missing his target. It was just that sort of high-level gig. He had no idea who had hired him, but he'd been doing this long enough to know the presence of heavy hitters.
Yes, one crappy night this is turning out to be.
He reached the rental car. The long-barreled pistol went under the front seat. He climbed into the driver's side and hit the button to start the engine, only it wasn't there. The button was gone. He was just looking at the mechanical innards behind it. What the hell was... He stopped wondering when the passenger's side door opened and the man who had knocked Decker down and saved his life stood there, his pistol trained on him. His gaze flicked up and down over this new man on the scene. The eyes were cold, colder than his had ever been, and somehow he didn't think this was the man's top range of ice. He was about 6 feet, lean, wiry, probably strong as an ox without all the muscle mass. Nimble, alert, quick in his ways, a pro. That could be read in the calm features as the rain poured down on him.
"Should I even bother to ask who you are?" he said.
The other man shook his head one time, and one time only.
"You fouled my shot back there."
One curt nod was the response to this statement.
"Full disclosure, I've got a lot of juice behind me. You can walk away from this or go down under the wheels. I'm not the only one out there. It's a good deal. Take it."
Another brief shake of the head.
"Then what do you want?"
It was then that the man spotted the suppressor on the end of the gun barrel pointing at him.
"You're making a huge mistake," he said. "This is a lot bigger than both of us." "First thing you've said that makes sense," said the other man.
He pulled the trigger once and drilled a hole in the other man's forehead. Dum-dum around. It stayed inside. The man slumped forward over the steering wheel. The other man had a comm bud in his ear and spoke into a mic tagged to his jacket. He gave the location and situation. He received an affirmative that cleanup would commence right away. He put the starter button back from where he had earlier taken it. Then he closed the door without looking at the man he had just shot dead. He slipped the pistol into a holster that rode on the back of his waistband and sprinted back to the spot where he had left Decker. Decker was still lying on his belly in the middle of the alley. With the falling rain, he was as soaked as though he had jumped, fully clothed, into a pool. When Decker saw the man heading down the alley, he called out,
"Hey, can I get up?"
"Affirmative." The man hustled over and helped him up. Decker could feel the strength in the other man's grip.
"Someone just tried to kill me," said Decker.
The man pointed to the hole punched in the brick.
.44-caliber steel jacket with an incendiary mini-explosive kicker. Someone really wanted to make sure that you would be joining the ranks of the dearly departed. But you saved my ass. Why? It's my job. Why? That's it. What happened to the other guy? He was my job, too. And what happened to him? That's it.
Decker looked flustered by this odd response.
What's going on?
We're counting on you to get us there, Mr. Decker. Who's us? I won't insult your intelligence. And if I can't get us there, not an option. That's your job. I'm here to investigate a murder. I don't know about the rest of this. I don't know about whatever element you're attached to. We're on the same team, just a different division.
Decker looked him up and down.
When did you get into town?
Just in time for you, it seems. How long have you been following me? Not long enough to really give you any answers. How did it go tonight, other than the shitheads and the shooter?
So you saw the shitheads too?
The man nodded.
I would have intervened, but you and your buddy seemed to have it covered, and revealing myself for the JV team was not an ideal use of my time. It would have spooked the guy who took the shot.
The shitheads had everything to do with my buddy and not with me.
But not the shooter. He had everything to do with you.
Someone doesn't want the truth to come out.
There's always somebody who doesn't want the truth to come out. So what did you learn tonight?
I learned about fracking, answered Decker.
The man studied him.
You consider that a good use of your time?
If you've got a reason why it's not, I'm listening.
Not enough for you not to cover that angle.
You obviously know something is going on in this place.
I just don't know the something. I'm not a detective. My talents lie elsewhere.
Did you get the shooter?
He won't be bothering you again.
We can question him, suggested Decker.
He won't be bothering you again.
Are you telling me he's dead? He could have led us somewhere.
He would have led us nowhere. Probably at least four layers between him and where we need to go. Waste of time. And we don't have time to waste.
Did you just kill him? Said Decker.
Does it matter to you?
I'm a cop. Shit like that does matter to me.
You let me worry about that. You do what you do. We're counting on you.
If this is such a big deal, how come we don't have more federal assets here?
Stealth, Mr. Decker.
Why do I think you didn't fly commercial into North Dakota?
It's a free country. You can think what you want. I won't stop you.
How do I get in touch with you then? And you with me?
We'll figure a way.
Can you tell me your name at least?
The man hesitated. The first instance of indecision Decker had glimpsed in the fellow.
It's Roby. Will Roby.
Chapter 25.
Will Roby? He told you his freaking name?
Jameson was staring across at a soaked Decker, who was leaning against the wall of her hotel room, dripping water on her carpet. Decker had come directly back to the hotel, knocked on her door, and woken her up, and now she was sitting on her bed in sweatpants and a long-sleeved t-shirt, staring at him incredulously.
Yeah, he did.
So let me get this straight. First, you got attacked by a bunch of morons, and you and Baker beat them up?
They were after Stan, not me.
Then someone tries to shoot you with an exploding bullet. Only this Roby guy saves your butt. After that, he runs off and takes out the guy who was trying to kill you. And then he comes back and intimates to you that there's something big going down in this town, and we're expected to find out what it is really quickly with no other assets coming our way.
That's actually a pretty good summary.
Jameson slumped against the headboard.
And this Will Roby actually said he was on our side?
Different division, same team, he said. But the most interesting thing I found out tonight was what Stan told me the guy from the air station said.
That we're sitting on a time bomb? Yeah, that's comforting,
she said sarcastically.
Stan thought his name was Ben, and he was in uniform, so it was before Vector took over out there.
And he didn't follow up with what the guy said?
Stan isn't a cop, and they were drinking at a bar at the time. Stan probably thought he was bullshitting.
But what the guy said obviously stuck with him.
Yeah, it did, conceded Decker, in retrospect.
So this Roby, what is he? Your guardian angel?
He was tonight. I'd be on a slab with my head literally blown off, but for him.
This comment drew a shiver from Jameson.
I'm never going to let you go out alone again. You always get into trouble. I mean, always.
I just went to have a beer and talk with Stan. I wasn't looking for any trouble.
Well, it always seems to find you,
she retorted. In a calmer tone, she said,
So how does this change our investigation?
There's no concrete proof that what happened tonight and Roby's appearance on the scene are tied to Irene Kramer's murder.
Can a place like London, North Dakota support two simultaneous dark conspiracies?
Decker swiped his wet hair with his hand.
Let's look at this logically. Kramer was 30. She came here a year ago and had a college degree.
We just have the people at the colony's word for that. And they said they didn't have any record of that other than what Kramer showed them.
That's true. But if she did earn her college degree, then from the age of 18 to 22 or so, she was in school. Then she comes here about 8 years later, and we can find no record of her before that. And the FBI's alarm bells go off when her prints come through their system.
And your point?
Kramer didn't have all that much time to establish herself as some international spy, like we were speculating before. In fact, she didn't have much time to do anything so remarkable that the Bureau would be hopping when her prints came through. But that's exactly what happened. And that's why I seriously doubt she was the catalyst for whatever had happened in her past. So we need to find out what was the actual catalyst.
But if not Witsec, what then?
Asked Jameson, her brow furrowed.
Because I can't think of anything else.
Well, I thought of one thing.
What was that?
He gazed at her with a pensive expression.
The sins of the parents can carry over to their children, Alex.
Jameson's puzzled look turned to one of understanding.
Kramer's parents? So it might have been something they did that led Irene to go underground and maybe change her name?
I'm sure she changed her name. We just have to find out who she really was.
We don't have a lot to go on.
We usually don't.
And we don't know that what happened to Kramer is tied to this ticking time bomb comment.
No, we don't, but we will figure it out.
I wish I were as confident as you.
Now get some sleep.
Wait, will you tell Kelly about what happened tonight?
For now, let's keep it between you and me.
Are you sure he is a local cop?
I'm not sure, but I'm trusting my gut.
He headed to the door.
Decker, promise me you're not going back out,
she said imploringly.
I'm going to slide the Bureau up against my door and sleep with one eye open and my gun in my hand.
Chapter 26. Decker didn't go to sleep, at least not right away. He sat fully dressed in his wet clothes on the floor. From his wallet, he took out two pictures. They were of his wife and daughter. Each had been taken shortly before their deaths. Tonight, he had come as close to dying as he ever had, he supposed. If this Roby fellow had been a second slower, or not there at all,
I'd be dead, like Cassie and Molly.
He peered down at their images. He hadn't looked at these pictures in quite a while. On the day of their funerals, he had been unable to speak, unable to really function. Tearful, devastated people kept coming up to him and saying how sorry they were. And he couldn't comprehend at the time what they were even trying to communicate. He felt as dead as his wife and daughter were. He had actually wanted to be dead, because he had no desire to keep on living while they could not. But then time passed. He grieved, mightily at first, too mightily because he came close to losing everything, including his own life. Then more time passed, and his days and nights were taken up with doing his job, interacting with others, even making new friends. The loss was still there. It would always be there. But the phrase, life goes on, appeared to be an accurate one. And from time to time, Decker would feel guilty that he was becoming so absorbed in his work that the memories of his family were receding into a little box in his head, only to be taken out from time to time and wept over. And for him, that equated with forgetting about his wife and daughter, or at least allowing other priorities in life to supersede what they had meant to him while alive. And this after he had promised them faithfully while standing over their graves, that they would be the center of his life until he joined them. A sense of betrayal steadily crept over him. A tear from his right eye fell onto Molly's photo. He very carefully brushed it away from the picture, fearful that it would mar her final captured image. He had told himself back in Burlington, where he'd been visiting their graves, that he could live in the past or live in the present, only he couldn't do both, although part of him desperately wanted to.
So what's it going to be, Amos?
He supposed all who had suffered such a loss struggled just as he did. That notion didn't console him at all.
We all feel alone. We feel unique in our pain.
He slid the photos back into his wallet and put it away. It was then that he noticed the bulge in his jacket pocket. He slowly put his hand in there and pulled out a phone. The answer hit him a second later.
Roby.
The man had slipped this phone into his jacket when he had helped Decker up in that alley. He had said he would figure out a way for them to communicate, and this must be it. He looked more closely at the device. It both looked and did not look like a typical mobile phone. He punched in the number of his own cell phone to see if it would go through. It didn't. He looked down at the phone, then simply pushed the green talk button. The phone made a small buzzing sound, and then the voice came on.
I expected you to be a little quicker on the uptake, said Roby. I've been waiting for your call for an hour.
I just found the phone and figured out how to work it.
Anything up, or are you just checking in?
The latter. So if I push the green button, you come running?
No. If you push the red button, I do. But I don't have a cape and superpowers, so don't expect me to be there in seconds.
So it's like a panic button, then?
And only use it when you are indeed panicked. Now, if there's nothing else, I'm going to get some shut-eye.
Sorry to bother you, said Decker brusquely.
I don't mean to sound like an asshole, Decker, but this is a job, a critical one. We're not here to make friends.
I wouldn't have it any other way.
Good.
But one more thing.
Yeah.
Thanks for saving my butt tonight.
You're welcome.
Roby clicked off. Decker stood, put the phone on the nightstand, stripped off his wet clothes and changed into dry skivvies. He lay back on the bed, suddenly wanting to be anywhere other than here. That was surprising, shocking even, because normally he wanted to be wherever there was a crime that needed solving. And right now, that was squarely in London, North Dakota. The first victim, Irene Kramer, had a mysterious past and might not have been who everyone thought she was. She was a teacher by day and doing something else entirely at night. She had been murdered and a post-mortem performed on her body, presumably by her killer. Something had perhaps been taken from her stomach or intestines. The man who had found her, Hal Parker, was looking for a wolf that had killed some cattle owned by Hugh Dawson. And now Parker was missing, and Pamela Ames was dead. Had Parker killed Kramer and Ames? But if he had, why pretend to find the body and call the cops? That put him right in the middle of the investigation, which made no sense. Now Decker came to Will Roby's involvement. He only had Roby's word for it that he worked for the federal government, but Roby had saved his life. And the man who had tried to kill Decker? Where had he come from? And finally, Decker came back to what his brother-in-law had said the man from the Air Force station had told him about sitting atop a time bomb. Did it tie into the row of ambulances at the facility? And did it explain the reluctance of the station's commander, Colonel Sumter, to cooperate with them? They had to find the man who had uttered those words, and he would need Baker's help in learning more about this fracking business. In Decker's experience, when there was money to be made, big money is here. That provided an excellent motive to kill. As if humans really needed a reason to hurt other humans. With that thought, he fell into a troubled sleep.
Chapter 27.
This looks like a command center, said Jameson.
She and Decker were inside a roomy trailer, staring at a series of computer screens set atop a long, laminated desk. They were at an oil rig site that was in the process of being fracked. Baker sat in a swivel chair in front of the desktop units, his gaze flicking alertly over each screen. The trailer had a bathroom and an AC window unit and was quite comfortable inside.
"That's exactly what it is," said Baker. "We actually call it the data center because that's what all this is," he added, pointing to the screens. "Data."
Jameson indicated a Maxwell House coffee can sitting on a table with its plastic lid on.
"You've got a Keurig over there, so what's that for?"
"Don't open that top," warned a grinning Baker. "It's the other supervisor's spit can. You can't smoke anywhere around a rig, so nicotine addicts chew tobacco instead."
"Great, thanks for the heads up,"
said Jameson, looking disgusted. Baker pointed to one screen.
"This monitors the barrels of fracking fluid we pump in the hole by the second."
"Is it important to monitor it that closely?"
asked Jameson.
"Oh yeah, because things can go sideways fast, and people might get hurt, and you could end up wrecking a wellhead site. Nobody wants that to happen. Now, we're just beginning to frack this well. The drilling and piping have all been done by a separate crew."
"How does all that work?" asked Decker.
"The initial well bore is drilled. After that's done, the drill pipe and bit are taken out. Then a steel tube, which we refer to as a surface casing, is put in the hole. That makes the sides of the well rigid and stable, and also prevents stuff from leaking out. Then cement is poured in to secure the casing tube. We pressurize the shaft to make sure it's holding okay, sort of like testing a plane fuselage. Then the drill pipe and bit goes back in, and the drilling continues vertically. When that's completed, the horizontal drilling starts up. We continuously lower in more casing and cement to make sure everything is secure. When that's all said and done, then comes the insertion of the fracking fluid. It's all done in stages, and each one takes about 2 hours.
"How many stages?" asked Decker.
"Nearly 100, said Baker.
"Good God,"
said Jameson.
"Why so many?"
"We're going down a long way, and we have to break up the rock in just the right manner and direction."
He went to the small window and pointed out.
"Those trucks will pump the fluid mix into the wellhead through all those connected pipes. Now, we've also got an artillery van where they prep the necessary explosives and attach the detonating gun to the perforating gun."
"An artillery van?"
exclaimed Jameson.
"Sounds like you're going to war."
"We are, in a way. Against some really tough subterranean rock that's a zillion years old and has never been disturbed before. We pump the gun down to blast fractures in the rock. Then the perforation device extends fissures or cracks that reach into the oil deposits, sort of like fingers poking in to get something. Then we drop a ball down and seat it in a plug. That isolates the area we're interested in, and that's when we start blasting fracking fluids into the rock cracks and fissures."
"What do the fluids consist of?" asked Decker.
He led them back over to the screens.
"It's a pretty well mapped out mixology of stuff. Sand and fresh water make up 99.5% of what we put down the hole. The rest are chemicals. Biocide to kill bacteria in the water so it can't foul the product. Then other chemicals to provide viscosity to the liquid. Guar gum, magnesium chloride, barite, hydrochloric and citric acid, ethanol and methanol, sodium erythorbate. All this stuff has different purposes. Some help with gelling, others with iron control, corrosion counteractor, clay stabilization, friction reducer, cross-linker, and the list goes on and on."
He grinned. "Hell, some days I feel like I've got my degree in chemistry 3 times over. These graphs over here chart the PSI in the pipe. We use regular sand, which we refer to as the propant, to start with, and then change over to ceramic sand, which holds the fractures open longer."
He glanced at Decker. "Like your stent analogy to unblock an artery. We use about 250,000 pounds of propant per stage.
That's a lot more than